I saw recently that Bill Gates is the richest man in the world again. I guess this is one of those things that kind of goes back and forth, you know, as your investments go up and down. But he was first the richest man in the world back in 1995, with about $13 billion. And he was around 40 years old at the time. He also had a New York Times bestseller, number one on the charts, I guess, for 7 weeks, his book was. And he, at that point, was just ready to unleash Internet Explorer on the world. Of course, he'd founded Microsoft years earlier, which is how he'd made all his dough. And at 31, he'd been the youngest billionaire in history. You look at Bill Gates and you think about all that he'd accomplished, you know, by 40. And you can look at 1 Kings 9 and 10 and you think, well, this is just another story like that, right? Another success story. Solomon, right, in the middle of his career, things are booming. 1 Kings 9, 1 tells us that Solomon built all that he desired to build. Or, as it's also been rendered, he did every deep desire that he wished to carry out. Solomon had a passion for building, and nothing was stopping it. Whatever he wanted to build, he built. And when we look at chapters 9 and 10, we can see that. A story of success. A story of a brilliant man who became incredibly rich and gained incredible fame. Right? Another Bill Gates or a Rockefeller or maybe another Elon Musk. But if that's all we see in 1 Kings 9 and 10, if we just see a success story, then we've really missed the point. Because the Bible isn't concerned about Solomon as a success story. Solomon as a guy who leveraged his talents and ability and his position to make something of himself. Now, when we look at 1 Kings, when we see Solomon's life, we see that we're reminded of how Solomon became what he became and why Solomon became what he became. That there was something behind it, there was a source to it, and there was a purpose to it. And if we lose sight of that and we just get caught up in, wow, that's a lot of gold. And let me tell you, you sit here, because it's all in the ESV, it's all told in talents. You could sit there with a calculator. I know, because I did. You know, it's like, whoa, how much gold is that? But that's only half the story. And when you turn to 1 Kings chapter 9, and I'd encourage you to go ahead and open up there if you're not already, we see that Solomon's success is set in context here by 1 Kings 9, verses 1 through 9. We're reminded, of course, that Solomon's blessings all come from the Lord, that he's their source. 1 Kings 9 tells us that as soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he'd appeared to him at Gibeon. The timing of this is, as we learn from verse 10, it's about 20 years into Solomon's reign. But we're taken back. We're reminded of the beginning of Solomon's reign. Right? When he still says, I'm young, I'm inexperienced, I don't really know what I'm doing. And he loved the Lord, and the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, ask what you want from me. And Solomon asked for wisdom, the wisdom to rule well. And it pleased the Lord. And so God told him that he'd give him wisdom, but he'd also give him riches and honor. But now, 20 years later, mid-career, the Lord appears to Solomon again. And this time, it's a different message that he comes to Solomon with. He begins, though, by telling Solomon, look, the prayers that you offered when you dedicated the temple, I heard them. Now, I think that was probably more a reminder to Solomon than sort of a new revelation. You'll recall that the Lord's glory filled the temple. He clearly had made his presence known in the temple at its dedication. But he now reminds Solomon that, yes, I have consecrated this house. He says to him, the Lord said to him in verse 3, I have heard your prayer and your plea which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. It's a reminder of God's gracious presence with Solomon and with the people. And then he goes on to remind Solomon that this relationship that he has, that Solomon enjoys with the Lord, is because of this covenant that God has established. Hear me talk about covenant when we talk about 1 Kings and you get tired of it. I'm sorry, but it's what undergirds 1 Kings is this relationship that the Lord has, this covenant that the Lord has entered into with his people, and in particular with the house of David. He says in verse 4, and as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father. This again is a reminder to Solomon, but it comes at an important time in Solomon's life. He, as we're going to look at in just a moment, has been enjoying unparalleled success. But the Lord reminds him. The Lord reminds him that what comes first, what should come first, what should be of utmost importance to Solomon, more than all the other things that he's doing, no matter how good they may be, is that he maintain his relationship with the Lord, that he walk in integrity with the Lord. Walk with a unified heart before the Lord, not a divided heart. That's the key. And of course, that's the key for any of us, right? Regardless of what God has brought into our lives, the most important thing is that we walk with integrity before the Lord, that we trust in him, that we walk in faith and obedience and love. And so then the Lord issues a warning. And this warning that the Lord issues to Solomon really is something that hangs over the next couple of chapters and really hangs over all the rest of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. He tells him, but if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name. For my name I will cast out of my sight, and Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. I say it's a warning that hangs over the rest of these chapters, because when this book was compiled, when the book of Kings was compiled, the people who first received it, they were living in exile. They knew that these things had happened. They knew what it meant to be a byword, right? To be something that, well, no longer standing as something of honor, but something of shame. They knew that the house of the Lord had become a heap of ruins. And so they understood how serious the warnings were. And when we think about God's covenant with David, there's some aspects of it that were unconditional. God promised he would send a king, one who would reign forever, that the line would be established forever. But the blessing of any individual king required that he trust the Lord. And so Solomon is reminded here at the midpoint of his career when things, well, in the middle of a golden age. And so, you know, we may stop, evaluate our lives. I know that no one here is enjoying the kind of success that Solomon was enjoying. Right? I mean, if you are, you're really hiding it well. But when we evaluate our lives, when we stop and we put it and we look back over it, and we say, where are we and where are we going? This has to be the priority. Remember, this has to be the priority. Are we walking in integrity with the Lord? Are we trusting Him? Everything else, as I've said, pales in comparison. But the author here, the Lord, He puts Solomon's success in a context for us. So we don't just read it and at the end of these chapters just go, gold, wow. You know, but we see what's really important. But we're reminded throughout these chapters that this blessing that Solomon enjoys really is a blessing from the Lord. Twice in chapter 9, we see this. 1 Kings 10:9, Queen of Sheba, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, He has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." And then, near the end of the chapter, after we see much more of Solomon's gold, "And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind." When we look at what Solomon achieved, it really is extraordinary. And I think when you read chapters 9 and 10, you should be a little blown away by it. In verses 10 through 14, there's a note here about his trade with Hiram. Remember, that's his trading partner just up the coast. And as a result of the trade that they were doing, Hiram, in addition to providing all the timber and everything else that he had to Solomon, he also provided 120 talents of gold. It's about 4.5 tons of gold. Right? It's a fair quantity of gold. And then we see Solomon's, another note that really tells us something about Solomon's passion for building and how that was being realized during his reign. Right? The temple has been built, an extraordinary building, as we already talked about. His palace, again, even more vast than the temple and hugely luxurious. Some other building around Jerusalem, the Milo or the Millo, people are kind of uncertain as to exactly what this was. Some sort of major public work, maybe a terracing that expanded the footprint of the city. But he builds walls. He rebuilds cities. He creates fortified cities for the defense of the land. He builds store cities. I mean, he's building everywhere. And he was... at least as building goes, if you went through the land of Israel, it would be, you know, like going through America or New York City and seeing like, oh, look, there's another Trump building. It's like, oh, look, there's another Solomon building. Everywhere he went, he was leaving his mark. And then in verses 26 through 28, we see that Solomon, with Hiram, he enters into an arrangement with him to build a fleet and have Hiram's men, who were real seamen, to extend his trade network. Because there where Israel was placed, they had great control of overland trade routes, you know, from Egypt and from Arabia coming up into the Fertile Crescent. But now he's extended into sea routes. And so he and Hiram bring gold from Ophir. Maybe in Arabia, maybe further east. We don't really know. But 420 talents of gold they bring. 16 tons of gold for Solomon. And this is what we get. We just get told more and more about his gold. Right? In chapter 10, verse 14, we're told, "Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold." That's 25 tons of gold a year. Like, what do you do with 25 tons of gold? And then we're told that he partially decorated the palace with shields that are covered in beaten gold. And of course, all his drinking vessels are gold. I mean, only the best for Solomon, right? You're not going to sit and drink out of silver. Come on. Why would you drink from silver when you've got gold everywhere? It seemed that everything he touched turned to gold. Now, is there a problem with all of this gold? Possibly. Yeah. But we'll talk about that next week. Because next week, we'll see that there were real problems that came later in Solomon's life. But right now, at this point, what we want to see is all of this gold, all of this blessing that the Lord has brought for Solomon, it has a purpose. And that purpose, I think, is really exemplified in this visit of the Queen of Sheba, which Kirk read for us earlier. Here in 1 Kings chapter 10. Verse 1 says, "Now when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon," right? Solomon's incredible wealth meant that his fame was spreading far and wide. The Queen of Sheba, she came from probably what's modern-day Yemen, down on the Arabian Peninsula. Was apparently a pretty remarkable place down there. They'd built one of the earliest known dams by which they were able to create a fertile pocket there. I mean, huge dam. They create a fertile pocket and control trade through the Arabian Peninsula. The water is coming through, extended over into Africa. Phenomenally wealthy, although apparently not more so than Solomon. But the Queen of Sheba, she heard about the fame of Solomon, probably from these traders who were passing through. But notice it isn't just that she heard of the fame of Solomon, she heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. That the report about Solomon that was going out into all the world was connected to the name of Yahweh. The people didn't just hear that, oh yeah, there's this fellow Solomon. Boy, is he rich. You should see his palace. But the report apparently perhaps included the news about the glory of the temple. The report that Solomon had remarkably achieved what he'd achieved. And that the Lord was somehow connected to all this. His God was responsible for this somehow. And so she heard about Solomon. She heard about his wealth. She heard about his wisdom. And so she came. And she came in state. Big, big affair. Huge retinue, right? Very great retinue. Came to Jerusalem with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. Now, she comes and she quizzes him. Now, part of this might have been sort of the banter of riddles and wisdom that was popular if you were an educated person in the day. You know, you knew riddles, and you would bring riddles, and you would ask one another riddles. And they were supposed to tell you some insight into the reality of things. And it may be that this is part of what they were doing. But it seems that the Queen of Sheba came with more than that as she came to Solomon to hear his wisdom. I mean, an extraordinary, extraordinary capacity in governance, extraordinary capacity for trade. You can only imagine the sort of questions that she may have asked him. As we learned earlier, he knew about everything from the smallest little shrub to the biggest trees. He'd studied it all. He knew it all. And so she came to learn from him, and probably to also engage in trade with this incredibly wealthy man. And so he answers all of her questions. And verse 4 tells us, "When the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her." It just took her breath away. She couldn't believe it. And she said then, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom. But I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report that I heard. Happy are your men, happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom." She looks at Solomon in the splendor of his court and all that he's accomplished, all of his building, And she says, wow, the people who serve here with you are incredibly blessed. And what a blessing to be able to even be your cupbearer. To hear these sweet words drip off your lips. Right? But it isn't just Solomon who receives honor. She says then, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness. Right, she had heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the Lord, and then she came and she saw Solomon's wisdom in action. She heard it for herself. She saw the fruit of that, and she said, blessed be the Lord your God. Look at how he has delighted in Israel to make you its king. And so Solomon's great success is not meant to end with Solomon. Solomon's great success is meant to be something that becomes a light, a beacon, that others would see the greatness of the God who was blessing Solomon, the greatness of the God that Solomon was in covenant with. What they were seeing is the glory of being in covenant relationship with the Lord. And we're told then that the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon, to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Right? When God's people are really living in covenant with him, there is something beautiful about that. Something which other people will see. Now in Solomon's life, God had promised him he would give him this sort of extraordinary wealth. Of course, for us, we're not told, we're not promised, and we should never imagine that we are, that everything we touch will turn to gold if we're just faithful. But our lives are likewise supposed to be a display to the world. That's what Jesus tells us. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Solomon and his wisdom and the splendor which God had blessed him with was something that went out as a report to the world and couldn't be hidden. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. God has brought us into covenant with him, and he blesses us, and he does so that we might be a display to the world of the glory of our Father. Now, of course, there's a shift in the dynamics here. For one, it's no longer the material prosperity. Instead, when we look at what Jesus has to say about this being this light to the world, what we're reminded of is that we're a light to the world as we are living in faithful obedience and trust in the Lord. You know, as we walk by faith, as our lives are increasingly governed by Christ-likeness, as we more and more exemplify the kind of life that Jesus describes in the Sermon on the Mount. That we are people who aren't governed by anger and aren't governed by our lust, and aren't governed by greed. People who have learned that godliness with contentment is great gain. Right? That we don't have to be seeking after riches in order to be happy. And if we do have riches, that we know how to use them in a way that's generous, in a way that honors God. We, like Solomon, are called to take what God has given us and be a light to the world. We're also called, though, to go out into the world with that light. We don't sit on our remarkable thrones waiting for the world to come and notice us. We are called to go out into the world, to be in the world, to be a display of God's glory. But for that glory to be truly a display of God's glory, it isn't enough that we simply live well. It's that we have to live well in a way that people know that this is coming from the Lord. This is coming from Christ. Right? The Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. It went out somehow with the name of the Lord. We're not just good people. We're not just good people who keep hidden the source. There are a lot of good people in the world. There are people who are better people than we are, who don't know anything about God. What is it that animates us? What is it that gives us strength and resolve? What is it that motivates us? And isn't it the gospel? Isn't it Jesus? Isn't it what he's done? Right, we see Solomon in all of his splendor, all of his glory, and we're reminded, as Jesus told the Pharisees who rejected him. He said, "The queen of the south, that is the queen of Sheba, will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Jesus could say to them, "Something greater than Solomon is here." You know, think about that. Think about that. The Pharisees, Jesus is, his teaching is remarkable. He's performing miracles. He's loosing people from the bonds of Satan, from demonic oppression. But if your eyes are fixed on the wrong things, can you look at Jesus and say, "Oh, he's greater than Solomon"? I mean, Solomon? Did you hear about Solomon's throne? He made a great ivory throne and overlaid it with the finest gold. The throne had six steps, and the throne had a round top. And on each side of the seat were armrests and two lions standing beside the armrests, while 12 lions stood there, one on each side of a step on the six steps. The like of it was never made in any kingdom. There's one greater than Solomon here, he says. So when we look at Jesus and we see him, even though he just looks like a poor carpenter, because that's what he was when he started his ministry. We look at Jesus and we see him in his lowliness and we recognize, no, there's something far more than just these outward appearances. There really is something here that's much, much greater than Solomon. Right? That there's a wisdom here that far surpasses the wisdom and knowledge of Solomon's. That the one that we see, the one that we look at, when we turn to Jesus, we're seeing the one who reveals God himself to us. Who knows the Father as no one has known the Father and can reveal the Father as no one else could ever reveal the Father. Who reveals the heart of the Father, the love of the Father, the wisdom of the Father. Who lays down his life for his people. We look at all of that and we say, yes, here is one who's glorious, far more glorious than Solomon. Far better than Solomon. And we trust ourselves to him. We entrust our very lives to him. And it's in doing that that we have any hope of living the kind of life that actually reflects the glory of our Father in the world. Unless we have entrusted ourselves to the one who is far more glorious than Solomon, unless we've said, yes, his goodness, his righteousness, his glory, that's what I rest in. We're never going to do anything more than glorify ourselves in the world. God blesses us. He calls us to himself. He calls us to put our hope in the one who is far more glorious than Solomon in all of his splendor. We put our hope, we put our trust in him and the nations. And the nations will see the glory of God. We know this will happen. As Kirk preached a couple of weeks ago, this is where history is headed. This is the end to which all things are coming. As we see in Revelation, the kings bringing their glory into the New Jerusalem. It's a picture of all of us, people of every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. Of all peoples, like the peoples who came to Solomon to seek his wisdom. But now all people's coming to seek the glory, the beauty of Jesus, the great King, our great King. So we look at our lives and we say, well, maybe we're at the midpoint of our career like Solomon. Maybe we're still toward the beginning. Maybe we're, you know, reaching maybe like the twilight of our career. Wherever we are, we look at our lives and we have to say, all right, Lord, whatever it is that you've given me to accomplish, am I doing this pursuing integrity of heart, walking with you, looking to Jesus? Is this what I'm about? Am I looking to Jesus? And as I'm looking to Jesus, then, can other people see your glory? Because that's why God has blessed us. All right, so we can enjoy King Jesus, but so others can see his glory too. Let's pray.